the Chief Justice, members of the court. This is a legal malpractice action that was filed in the city of St. Louis that raises fundamental questions about the interpretation of the venue statute, section 508.010, as well as this court's rules regarding motions to transfer, and specifically rule 51.045. As the court is aware, under the venue statute, in tort actions, and legal malpractice is a tort, venue is determined by where the plaintiff was first injured by the alleged negligent conduct. And in your 2008 Selimanovic opinion, you stated that to determine the location of first injury in a legal malpractice case, you look at the injury sought to be redressed. And if the injury sought to be addressed is financial loss, then the plaintiff was first injured where the financial loss occurred. The plaintiffs here are St. Charles County residents and the business that they owned and operated in St. Charles County. The injury they seek to redress is the loss of that business when a preliminary injunction was entered by the Florida District Court requiring them to cease operations in St. Charles County. They claim that the Florida court order was the result of negligent advice they got on the cancellation of a franchise agreement. But it's clear that the damages they allege are financial losses. Specifically, they allege the money they spent for startup costs, like inventory and vehicles, and projected lost profits, wages, and income they would have received had this business been able to operate for 4 years.
So the injunction that was entered that resulted in their damages was before the settlement in federal court.
That's
in Florida?
Correct, Judge.
Because your opponents are saying that the action in Florida in the federal court was the first injury.
They're alleging that it was the first injury, and the preliminary injunction, which is entered October 6th, they refer to the motion to compel arbitration, or the compelling of arbitration. That was a couple months later, and then there was a settlement in the context of that. But it was the preliminary injunction that directed that they cease operations in St. Charles County, and it's the loss of those operations, that are the gravamen of their petition.
Now, the settlement that was entered later, clearly now,
yes.
Was that a closed settlement? Was that sealed? I mean, do we know the terms? I mean, was your client out some money?
It's not in the record. Okay. But clearly, if you're looking at first injury, the first injury would have been precipitated by the preliminary injunction. But the loss has occurred in St. Charles County. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, why we moved. In the original petition, their allegation as to why venue was proper in the city was that that's where Hepler Broom's offices were located. That's where the legal advice would have been given. Well, it's been clear since at least Selimanovic that that is not the basis for venue in a legal malpractice action. Again, it's where you were first injured. So we moved to transfer this case to St. Charles County, and the respondent denied that motion, and in doing so, she relied on an argument that was raised for the first time in an untimely reply, and that was the argument that the first injury was the Florida litigation.
Why wasn't the motion deemed overruled, if not ruled on in 90 days, and the rule clearly requires to be transferred to St. Charles? So But I don't think I'm arguing against you. I'm just suggesting that you filed a motion saying it was St. Charles. The judge could look at their petition, and there's all those St. Charles damage issues there. And then there's nothing that happens. So after 90 days, regardless of what arguments anybody made after the fact, under the rule, after 90 days, why wasn't the trial court ordered to transfer to St. Charles?
Well, again, Judge, all we know is the trial court did not order it. Within that period of time. In other words, the sequence here was we filed our motion to transfer. It was set for argument, I believe, on November 28th. We filed our motion October 6th. About 6 weeks after we filed our motion, they filed a reply. We raised the issue of the timeliness of the reply. They made an oral motion for the court to accept it out of time at the hearing, and then she took it all over submission. And all we know after that is 7 months later,
okay.
she denied the motion.
We have rules regarding timing, though, that it, regardless of whether she granted, sustained, denied, whatever, took in her advisement, if pursuant to the rule it was deemed denied at the end of 90 days, why does anything that occurred after that, why is it relevant to these? Why is anything that occurred after the time it was deemed denied relevant to these writ proceedings?
Well, Your Honor, because what we have, the operative order and the order that we appealed, was her order denying the transfer, and that we sought the writ on. And obviously one ground that we sought the writ on was that the court should be, again, there should be a written prohibition and she should be restrained from taking any action other than transfer it. So that's the form in which we brought the 90-day issue to a head.
I think, and you're saying you're relying on where it says shall be deemed granted if not denied within 90 days?
That's correct, Your Honor. Unless the parties waive the 90 days, which does happen, and I've done it, but it did not happen here. Mm-hmm. So essentially our argument is that the preliminary writ should be made permanent for at least three independent reasons, each of which is sufficient in and of itself. One is, as I said, under the venue statute, the first injury was in St. Charles County, where the alleged financial losses occurred. Secondly, that under Rule 51045, the court was required to grant the motion to transfer because the plaintiffs didn't file a timely reply. And thirdly, what Judge Stith alluded to and what the Chief Justice referred to was the 90-day requirement. Any of those are sufficient.
Well, can you address for me why you have to show good cause before the 30 days is over? Why can't you show good cause later? You say you can't, and you point to part of 41001, I think, but there's that second part that does let you seek, for excusable neglect, does let you seek an extension of time after the time otherwise would have run. This rule doesn't distinguish between before or after, but I'm not sure. I know you're inferring it has to be before, and I'm asking why.
4401 says two, I think, important things. One, it says that if there is a time period specified in the rule, that the court may grant an extension on its own motion or no motion if it's requested within that time period.
Right. The first part does. Uh-huh.
That didn't happen. The second thing that it says, and again, we presume it's applicable because it isn't one of the rules that's
exactly
excluded. The second thing it says that if you're beyond that period, then you have to file a motion, provide 5 days' notice, and demonstrate excusable neglect. That didn't happen here.
So is the question for us on appeal whether there was excusable neglect or was that?
I don't think you even get there, Judge, because there was no motion. There was no attempt to comply with 4401B2.
Well, they didn't file a motion under that. They did file a motion after the hearing, didn't they? Or at the?
They filed a motion at the time of the hearing because we raised the report.
Absolutely.
The timeliness in a response to their reply.
Mm-hmm.
They made an oral motion and then 2 days later filed a supplemental written document.
And I know you think it's not sufficient. I just wanted to hear more specifically why that would not be adequate, why the backfill sort of is not sufficient.
Not sufficient, Judge, because, again, it doesn't comply with the rule. And I think the rule's there for a reason. All of these rules, and I think the whole theme of this case is the whole purpose of the venue statute as part of tort reform. And I would submit the reasons for Rule 51.045, particularly as it was modified in 2012, is to make sure that venue issues are dealt with efficiently and expeditiously early in a case so that the court and the parties don't waste time litigating in the wrong venue or the proceedings are not unduly delayed, which they normally, there is a delay when you have a venue issue in a particular case. And I think what the rule is saying, you lose that if these deadlines aren't taken seriously. Whether it's the 60 days to file the venue motion, the 30 days to reply, or the 90 days to the rule, absent the consent of the parties. And again, what I think the rule is and the statute is designed to do is to force the parties in the court to deal with the scheduling issue.
And with respect to the 90-day limitation and the statute, was there ever a motion or a request to the court to say, hey, Judge, that 90 days has expired. You have to be deemed, this motion has to be deemed granted.
No, Judge.
Well, how does the judge not know that there's not consent in that issue? Maybe you guys decided.
But it has to be written, Judge. The statute says it has to be written consent. And again.
But you're asking the court to find that the circuit court abused its discretion for doing something he or she didn't even know that they were supposed to do.
Not so much abuse its discretion. Obviously, at that point, at least according to the statute, it didn't have the authority to deny the motion anymore. I think part of it is, first of all, obviously, as the movement, you believe and are hopeful your motion is going to be granted. The second thing is, we haven't gotten any guidance from this court on the implications of the 90 days. There's been this suggestion, we have the argument here, that it's inconsistent with Rule 51.045. And so as a result, I think there's some uncertainty.
Is the court required to transfer the case to an improper venue?
The court is required to transfer the case to a venue designated in the motion.
Even if it's improper?
Well, again, that's not part of the determination. It was under the old Rule 51.045. But it's not under this rule. And so, again, and the rule, like I said, the language with respect to the rule is very clear. And it says that if no reply is filed, which we submit as no timely reply, the court must transfer the case to the county specified in the transfer motion. And there's no additional determination as to whether it is proper or improper. It's presumably proper by virtue of the fact it's authorized by the rule. But this court changed that rule, and we submit they changed it, or you changed it, to respond to the Jennings case. Also, I think, to expedite these determinations with respect to venue.
It and used so, to require you, the court, to always make a determination of whether venue was proper in the jurisdiction to which it would be transferred, and we changed that.
Well, in Jennings, Your Honor, you indicated that the court, because of the wording of Rule 51.045, that there had to be a determination, a threshold showing whether venue was indeed improper where the plaintiff filed the lawsuit. That was eliminated with the amendments to Rule 51.045. And I would think that one of the reasons it was, again, to expedite the venue determinations and to consistent with the venue rules generally and indeed the 90-day requirement.
Opposing counsel raises an argument that the 90-day requirement could unduly restrict discovery, and there's reasons why one might need more time.
Well, the question for this court is whether there's an inconsistency, and there clearly is not, for the same reason that there wasn't an inconsistency in City of Normandy versus Greitens, which you decided last year. You can comply with both. In this particular case, first of all, when you do have discovery in situations involving venue, it's normally limited focus discovery. And again, the goal here is to get it done quickly, early in the case.
Does the rule limit discovery when a reply is filed?
No, it indicates that in light of the reply, the court can decide to order discovery. The other thing that I think is very important is overlooked is there's specific provision there that 90 days can be waived with consent of the parties. And if, in fact, the situation is such that the court believes or one of the party believes that the venue motion can't be deliberately addressed within the 90 days, then either that party, and I've had it happen to me, plaintiffs have requested of me and I've agreed to it, or the court can request that the parties waive the 90 days. I don't know of any reported case. I mean, that 90-day requirement's been on the book here for well over a decade, and I'm not aware of any case law indicating that it's interfered in any way with the venue determination process.
Is there any case applying it, though?
Discovery.
Is there any case applying it?
applying the 90 days?
We looked and certainly there is no appellate opinion.
Not sure it's come into play in any.
And I think that goes back to the question earlier as to whether it should be brought to the attention of the court or what the appropriate procedural mechanism is. Like I said, I think there's uncertainty in the circuit courts and among litigants as to what it means and how it should operate. And hopefully this case is a vehicle for this court to provide that clarity.
We'll reserve the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Please the court. This court's decision in City of Jennings was rendered in 2007. The argument that's being made by the relators is that in 2012, an amendment to the rule 51045 somehow implicitly and never articulated overruled City of Jennings, and it clearly did not.
We did get rid of the language Jennings relied on in saying that the court has to make a determination about venue before transferring it.
I understand. Your Honor, the specific holding in Jennings is that this court placed a very common sense onus and burden on
Absolutely.
The movement.
But then we changed the wording of the rule.
Would you have changed the rule with the intent that defendants thereafter could just simply file a change of venue motion, pick any venue
well,
that they
not,
would
not
choose.
Not without giving you an opportunity to reply and suggest.
But has it turned
that
into...
That it was wrong, or that it might be, or in some places it is, you have an absolute right to venue, that you might prefer another place.
Based upon the number of inhabitants, Rick,
right.
Of course.
Right.
But still, surely there is an onus.
Perhaps the reason is that if opposing counsel doesn't bother to file a reply, the court doesn't need to get in the middle of a struggle where there's only one side to it. And simply, we don't need to impose that burden on the court at that point if the opposing counsel doesn't want to oppose it, because venue is not jurisdictional.
Of course. However, in City of Jennings, surely the holding is still and logically would always be that a trial court still has to find that there's proper venue. Is the defendant literally going to be allowed now to simply file a change of venue motion, even where the rule says no reply?
So I understand the logic, and certainly that's what Jennings said. What if someone filed defendant filed a motion for change of venue and plaintiff agreed? Does the court still have an independent duty to make a determination of the propriety of venue? I think that's what maybe the change is getting to. How much burden, independent burden, are we putting on the court to do the work the parties should be providing guidance on?
In my experience, coming up on 30 years, every time there's been a stipulation, I've never had a problem getting a judge's signature without...
So how about not filing an opposition? Is that a very comparable situation? And is the rule treating it the same?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
Both the previous rule and the existing rule, under both, no reply is even required to be filed. The rules are explicit. And again, going back to City of Jennings, still good law as we sit here, the trial court has to
find. He was interpreting a rule that no longer exists. You agree with that?
I would agree that there was a modification to the rule, but the specific language and the holding of City of Jennings was to put the onus on the movement to specify how is it that you believe venue is improper. Surely they still have to comply with the statute. Surely there's going to be some kind of analysis under Section 508 why you're trying to claim that the first injury was, in this instance, they're trying to claim where my clients reside instead of the actions of a corporation out of state imposing a judgment upon my clients.
But didn't Jennings rely upon the prior version of 51045 that required the defendant to make a threshold showing, and the current version of 51045 does not require that threshold showing?
The specific language in subsection A is not all that distinct. Subsection A, as it was read at the time of Jennings, simply said that for venue to be considered, it has to be determined, and the moving party has to show that it was brought in an improper venue.
Whether the change was a wise one or not, I think the key language I'd like you to address is not A but C, because A clearly requires a showing of why venue's improper and why it's proper someplace else. But
correct.
C says, if no reply is filed, the court shall order transfer to one of the counties specified in the motion. It seems fairly direct and doesn't say if it finds that is proper, whereas it did say that before.
I understand.
Whether it's a good idea or bad, if we're stuck with this language right now in this case, how do we interpret it the way you would like us to?
I still believe the onus is on the movement to articulate why, under the statute, you believe it's proper where you're asking it to go.
To rule for you, though, we have to read that language into the rule, that we'd have to read into the rule that there must be a showing that the proposed change of venue is legally proper for any of the other provisions in the rule to take effect.
I believe this court's decision in sitting of Jennings, which still imposes the onus on the moving party, still exists. I don't know how anybody gets around that.
Well, let me ask you this, because it also says if they had not filed within 60 days, they've waived the venue issue. So it looks like to me there's comparable provisions of waiver. In other words, if they don't file their venue motion in 60 days, then yes, it goes forward in an improper venue, even if that's what the facts are. And if they move for venue and you don't respond timely, that yes, a case could go forward in an improper venue. What's unfair about that, that puts the parties on notice that if they don't act at the beginning of a case, that they're going to be in a venue that may or may not be improper?
As I understand where you're asking the direction.
Yeah, you're suggesting that you know, there has to be this threshold determination, but there isn't the other way around. The rule clearly says if they don't file a timely motion for venue, then improper venue is waived. And my suggestion to you is the way the rule's written, it's kind of a what's fair for the goose is fair for the gander approach. If you think that one of those suggestions is improper, you have to respond or that it's waived.
The premise of your question as poised, the way I'm hearing it, is that no response is filed by the plaintiff in opposition, which is not the circumstance of what happened here. And going back to what...
So why don't you address why it's timely and all this is just hypothetical that we've been talking about?
The Eastern District just recently came out with a case in September, I believe September 18th, in the Mylan Pharmaceuticals, addressing the specific issue about filing a response out of time and defined what exactly is good cause for leave to file. And it can be any mistake. It can be anything.
Well, excusable neglect, though, is what 4101 B requires, which you're relying on. And you didn't address that, did you? Or the court didn't find that?
The court made no specific findings.
Did you claim excusable neglect and good cause in your motion? And what did you show for that?
In the written motion that supplemented the oral argument, because relators had not raised any issue of timeliness until the night before. It was a late night filing of the day before the scheduling of the oral argument. So when they raised that in the argument, I asked for leave to supplement. Sure. I filed that, and then when the trial court issued her order, she made no mention.
But tell me what you alleged was excusable neglect or good cause.
That it was just simply miscalendared.
And is there any cases saying that's excusable neglect or good cause?
I don't know that there is a specific case, but this particular motion court, the trial judge, was very familiar with me. She has known me for 20 years. So I assume she takes that into account.
Okay.
Now, separately, regarding the 90-day issue contained within the statutes, again, Rule 41 overrules any and supersedes all statutes that are inconsistent with it. The rule understandably, does not place a time limit. Under Rule 5105, there is absolutely no time limit in which a trial court would or should have to grant a motion to transfer venue. This court understands, and the rule is explicit, that it allows for discovery. Now, I don't know any lawyers who can drop their entire calendar when they're dealing with venue motions if discovery is going to be ordered and get something like that done in a period of 90 days. The statute explicitly requires the transfer within 90 days, and it is fundamentally and basically inconsistent with the rule. The rule trumps the statute.
We haven't addressed the initial issue, which is where is venue proper? Where is venue proper? Your argument is that it was proper in St. Louis
City.
Can you address that and the issue about where the injury occurred?
Sure. There is no dispute that it was a order imposing an injunction upon my clients in the U.S. District Court for the Central District of Florida.
That's what caused the injury, but where'd the injury occur? Opposing counsel says the injury occurred in St. Charles.
Right, and they make this injury occurred by making this chain of events argument that ultimately, because my clients are operating their business back in Missouri, that's where the injury occurred.
I think they're trying to compare it. Say if you were in a corporate headquarters and you made a bad decision to sell a defective product or to do so, or a warning decision, what warnings to put on. That's not where the injury occurred. That's where the injury-causing conduct occurred. That's where the event occurred that caused the injury. And they're comparing the Florida preliminary injunction to that. Can you explain why that's not a good comparison or?
Because it's a singular molecular event. It's one act. It's like trying to take the white out of paper. How can you possibly say that a judgment that is entered in a U.S. District Court in Florida putting you out of business is not the injury-causing, trauma-causing event?
I think they're saying it doesn't matter what's the injury-causing event, it's where the injury occurred. Is that a false distinction?
It is a very false distinction. Again, I don't know how you separate a U.S. District Court's judgment that
puts
you out of business.
And it was a preliminary injunction, so it wasn't a judgment, right?
True. The order and decree, however, put them out of business and compelled them into arbitration, which eventually caused the settlement. And, Your Honor, you had asked earlier, is it a sealed document? It absolutely is sealed for very good reasons. That's why the document is not within the pleadings.
You're explaining why it's a false distinction, you think, between the injury-causing event and the injury?
My clients would not be put out of business but for a Florida judgment. It is literally that simple. Subsection 5 of 508.10 specifically deals with this very scenario where you've got conduct committed out of state that causes the injury. Venue shall be where the corporate registered agent is located, and that's why they're in St. Louis City. That's where Hepper Bloom is. That's where the registered agent is. This is not a complicated scenario. And this idea that you're going to create this chain of events determination, you could literally drag anybody anywhere in the country to say, well, no, your damages happened wherever you ended up at.
Are you distinguishing between injury and damages? That is, that the damages might have been in St. Charles, but the injury was in Florida?
That's the determination they're making, and my response to that is you cannot make that distinction. It's a singular molecular event. It happened in one place by one person, a U.S. District Court judge, who had jurisdiction over my clients and put them out of business in Florida, although they reside back here. But that's the argument, Your Honor, that they are making, that you make a distinction between first trauma and damages, and you can't. Again, it's like trying to take the white out of paper. It's intricate. It's molecular. It's a single thing. It cannot be broken up like that.
So basically, anytime there's a judgment that's harmful to your to someone, that's where the injury occurred, wherever the judgment was entered. Do we have any cases that address that in Missouri or elsewhere on how?
I am not familiar with.
Yeah. I'm not either. I just wondered if this scenario had come up.
I'm plugging. You know, this is square peg, square hole. I've got facts that fit 50810. I've got injury out of state under 50810, subsection 5, corporate defendant, St. Louis City. Square peg, square hole. Venue is in St. Louis City. It's not that complicated. I don't have anything else unless there's further questions. Thank you.
Judge, maybe Mr. Bagsby did so unintentionally, but he talked about the preliminary injunction caused the injury. Again, there's no dispute the financial loss occurred in St. Charles County. Under Selimanovic, this court concluded that's what you focus on to locate the injury in a legal malpractice case. There are no allegations in the petition or even the untimely reply of any financial loss in Florida. As the court has already pointed out, with respect to that the court cannot order transfer if there even or that no reply is required, obviously 51045 says if no reply is filed, the case shall be transferred.
Why can't we presume the trial court made all the factual findings necessary to support its judgment? So by treating the merits of the motion, they must have filed, found that there was excusable neglect. They didn't have to actually make
Well, obviously, Judge, you don't even reach the excusable neglect issue because there wasn't any attempt to comply with the rule with respect to the notice and motion.
But you just had a hearing the day before, so is there really any point to the notice?
Oh, absolutely, Judge, because again, then you're focused on the whole issue of excusable neglect. All we have here, and we have no ruling by the court.
Did their motion refer to Rule 4101?
No. Okay. No, which distinguish it from Mylan Burtek, the case he cited, where they did comply with Rule 4401. All we had is a reference to, I believe that it was inadvertence or oversight. And that's where the symmetrical aspect of it, I guess if you're trying to assess, is that excusable neglect? And obviously our case doesn't turn on it. But let's put the shoe on the other foot and say you missed the 60-day requirement to file your motion to venue. And then you file a motion and say, Judge, I forgot, inadvertence, oversight, that's excusable neglect. If in fact, and I think that's why the rules were amended, I think that's why the motion requirements are relatively strict, if that's enough, then these deadlines don't mean anything anymore. And the whole purpose, I would submit, of the modifications to 51045, obviously I think the purpose of the requirement in the tort reform statute, was to, again, get these determinations made early and efficiently. And I think all they do with respect to schedule and discovery is they force the litigants and the court to communicate.
You know, the only case out there that kind of has any bearing against your argument is that Kansas City Southern Railway Company, the 2009 case by this court. The situation was a little different, but it said there's no bright line rule with respect to immediate transfer of venue.
Well, again, Judge, that was before the 2012 amendments, which I think couldn't be clearer, and clearly were intended to create some automatic rules to maybe ease the burden on the courts with respect to these venue determinations. And I think the reason they were amended with respect to Jennings, as I said, one of the reasons the amendment, I think, was to address the Jennings problem. The other thing was to align the rules with the traditional allocation of the burden of proof. And we cite, for example, the Igo case. The traditional allocation of the burden of proof is the plaintiff. When venue is challenged, the plaintiff has the obligation, has the burden, to demonstrate the propriety of venue where he or she has filed the lawsuit. And what 51045 did is, I think, bring the rules consistent with that historic traditional allocation of the burden. And again, I think the purpose of all of this is to ensure that venue issues are resolved early and efficiently. That's done by enforcing the rule, by enforcing the statute, and we ask for those reasons that the preliminary writ be made permanent.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.